So now we're going to resume the session with question and answers. What I'm going to do is have people come up and speak from this microphone. What I'd like you to do is keep your questions short. When you come up here, I'd like you to introduce yourself, state your name, and then ask your question, preferably in 90 seconds or less, and then we'll have Dr. Myers respond. So we'll start with the question and answer session, and if you'd like to come up, and I'll start with a question on my right, Knutie.
My name is Knut Peterson. I'd like to ask Dr. Myers about his opinion on the federal budget just brought down a few days ago. Is there anything in the manufacturing industry for to be happy about?
Next year, I thought I was going to get scot-free and away from questions about the budget. Well, the government has, in the last economic statement, done a lot of good things in reducing the general corporate tax rate for business. And we said to them at that time that that was very important because that gets you into the game of global investment. Issue is that it doesn't give you a lot of chips to play with, particularly as countries around the world are and states and municipalities around the world are putting a lot of money on the table to attract investment and to keep investment, to encourage innovation and skills and training and new technology. So, and companies to come and stay. So we were looking for, I think we made our request very clear to what we were looking at inspecting from the government, that they had introduced a two-year write-off in the last federal budget for manufacturers for their equipment. That runs out, ran out at the end of 2008. This new budget extended it for one more year and then goes back to kind of a declining depreciation rate. And we were very clear that that had to be put in place for 5 years. And 5 years was necessary just because for many companies it takes a long period of time to get the equipment and put it in place and get regulatory approval for it. So the new measure will have some impact. The federal government is expecting it to be about $155 million. But this is $155 million new incentive out of $20 billion that would otherwise be spent in investment in manufacturing. And in the course of the budget, I know the federal government says it doesn't have a lot of money to spend, but it did have a $10 billion surplus that it miscalculated this past year. And this is a $6 billion budget that it's presenting. And you are in the most important single measure for manufacturing. And you say you've done this with $155 million. And we're saying that just doesn't cut it. We've got a $250 million investment fund in automotive. But working that out, it's about $10 million per year if it just goes to the major companies itself, not to the auto parts companies. And $10 million a year isn't going to have any impact at all. So we were hoping that the government would take more action. There are some good measures in the budget, improvements in the R&D tax credit system and everything else, but it certainly didn't go very far in meeting our requirements. We were very specific about it, and we were pretty harsh on them. We said we called the budget Disadvantage Canada, and it wasn't a jab at the government, although that's what the Prime Minister's office thinks it is. They were pretty harsh on me, saying you've been far too negative. You're way out there. You're more rabid than Buzz Hargrove. thanks. But I think I'm accurately representing the feeling of most manufacturers across the country that. We didn't expect government to solve the problem, so we expected much more, government to be much more active in helping out on what has to be done to encourage investment, and they didn't deliver on that, and we were very critical.
My name is Van Christu. I must say that I feel we're privileged today to have an economist introduced to us who knows what he's talking about. In your comments, you talked about the importance of innovation in the industrial area, and how important it is for us, especially now with this global community that we have, to not only keep up with what's going on, but hopefully to get ahead of what's going on. You also mentioned the importance, you touched on the importance of the infrastructure of transportation as it relates to industrial development and so on. Here we're in the midst of a provincial election where I haven't heard a single representative, a person who wants to represent us, even talk about transportation in this province. It's as though they're all talking about the past, the things that are happening in the past. We're living in a world now where China is putting in 400-mile-an-hour trains. What are we doing here to compete with that sort of thing? If we're going to increase the industry in this province, and we do not take care of the transportation, we're going to be overridden with roads and parking lots and a disaster such as has never happened before. What is your thinking on the basic importance of the development of our transportation system in relation to what's going on in the rest of the world?
Okay. Thanks, Vanna. That's a really good question. I think, transportation and logistics. I mean, this is, when we're looking at transportation, you've got to also look at the borders and security and the communications infrastructure that goes around it to make it work successfully. I think Canada is in a tremendous position we can position ourselves, if we want to, as the logistics hub of North America. Our ports are closer, even on the East Coast, to Asia and to Europe than any other ports in the Americas, including any port in the United States. We are closer to the customers, closer to the suppliers anywhere around the world. We have a great opportunity because we have rail systems and port systems that are not bottlenecked like they are in the United States. So at the same time, I think we've got a great opportunity to position ourselves between the growing trade with Asia and Europe on one hand and what's going on in the United States. So we can position ourselves as the logistics hub of North America if we want to do it. I don't see very much in the way of... I see the infrastructure projects still seem to be undertaken from the fact that you've got some money, we'll throw it at a specific project. There's no kind of big strategy here at all. I think you're right on the other hand, too, in terms of how do we, if we're serious, more and more concentrated populations, that is silly if we think that we're going to continue just to build roads around this. This is not, cannot be the future here. And I think Canada, in the past, has, if you really want to look at what made our economy extremely competitive, it was investment in infrastructure, in energy, and in education. Those were the three, a government that does that and sees that as an important part of its policy development is really investing in communities and in the economy. So very concerned that we're not talking about these issues. I think there's a great opportunity there, but Brian's very—he's very active, and with a counterpart in British Columbia, with the Alberta government, BC government, and talking about some of the bottlenecks here in Western infrastructure, and a lot of problems there. A lot of these are tied up in regulatory issues, and too. We can't believe it or not. There are certain trucks that if you filled up a truck in BC, you couldn't drive across this country because of different trucking standards here. This is crazy, and those are the things that we've got to address as well. So I think that's important. But you said something very interesting about innovation, and I think it's, I wanted to just come back to this because I think it's an important topic, and Chris and the group up at the university were talking about this in business class today too, when it comes to skills and education. I think there's a huge difference between the billions and billions of dollars that's being funneled into research and what we need in order to take the research and turn it into innovation. In my mind, research is all about transforming money into knowledge. That's what research is. Innovation is taking that knowledge and creating wealth from it, creating jobs, creating opportunity from it. And you do that by providing a solution. Innovation's about providing a solution. We kind of talked today we talked about skills and what the students up at the university, what they had to offer their employers coming out. We talked about they offer solutions for their employers. They offer their skills are going to be, you know, they're going to be useful if their employers can take advantage of them, of the skills they bring to mind. And we talked about, you know, everybody here, we all have computers, and how many of you are, you know, when you phone up the IT specialist and say, I got a problem with my computer, and you get this long, long spiel that he tells you everything he knows about computers, and you say, I really don't care, I just want it fixed. You know, that's what this is all about. You need the fix. You need the solution. You don't need all the technical expertise that goes into it. And I think it's the same thing when we look at education, when we look at innovation. And when you're a business, what you've got to focus on is what is the solution? What's the fix that you're trying to get? And then we can talk about where the, you know, what has to be done in order to create the young people that we need and the linkages between the universities and the research on one hand and those companies that take those products to market. So that's a part of that infrastructure as well, I think.
My name is Doug Miller. The lead story in the Calgary Herald today raises two interesting facts that in 2008, we will be investing about $20 billion into the tar sands in a very small area, which is equal to total investment in all manufacturing in Canada. There's a man, David Cross, who works for Statistics Canada, who is responsible for a current analysis. And he raises this interesting question, but there is no answer. How could we have other manufacturers in Canada benefit from all this investment in the small area around the tar sands?
Hi, Doug. That's a really good setup question because Brian has been taking the lead on a project that we have to connect manufacturers and other businesses across Canada with some of the business opportunities coming out of oil sands development. And it's important for a couple of reasons. Clearly, there's going to be a lot of investment going into the oil sands. We've been partnering with the Alberta government in doing this, and they figure that between oil sands investment and infrastructure investment in Alberta, there's going to be about $153 billion going in the next 10 years. And they say that's going to generate about $1 trillion of business opportunity. So for manufacturers across the country that have really been challenged in selling into the United States, well, here's a great business opportunity. And for Alberta companies that are finding real problems in finding enough labor or expanding capacity to meet some of the growing demand, well, there are opportunities here to partner with other companies across Canada to help them solve some of their capacity issues, help them kind of deliver for their customers some capacity that they can partner elsewhere in the country. So there's a great interest here. And we've been working on trying to make those connections. But I got to tell you, it's difficult. It's very difficult to tell someone who has been, it's very difficult, first of all, to get people's attention. You might as well be, in Alberta, you might as well be in China, as far as people in Ontario are concerned. It's true. Brian is running a big buyer-seller forum in Edmonton at the end of March. We had one last year. And what struck me, we had so many companies coming from Ontario, and they come out. They don't know who the players are. They don't know what the market is like. They don't know what they have to do in terms of lead time, delivery times to be competitive. They haven't done the research. They don't know the labor conditions here. They don't know how to best approach the market. Now, I'm exaggerating, of course, because there are a lot of companies that do, and they do their homework. But it showed me that some of the same challenges you have for companies going into China here. There's a lot of work that has to be done. And in Ontario, I was talking to a bunch of tool and die makers about China, and I said at the end of my presentation, you should be looking at Alberta. And someone firsthand goes up and says, well, how much automotive is there in Alberta? But, you know, these guys are machining. They're machining for the automotive industry, but the point is, if you're machining, you're machining, and why don't you machine for the energy industry? But a part of it that goes to changing the business model and changing the leadership and the leadership of the organization itself and seeing a new business plan. But the other there are some really really big impediments, because you go from a high precision, high volume, small scale production for the automotive industry, and now you're talking about big scale, customized manufacturing, modular manufacturing for the oil sands industry, and there's some big, it's not that easy an adjustment either. But you're absolutely right, tremendous opportunity, and I think one of the problems that we have in this country is a huge lack of communication, because in Ontario, all too often, and across the rest of the country too, oil sands is seen to be an Alberta benefit. And we're doing everything we possibly can to say this is a huge benefit for the rest of the country and for any business out there if they're not looking at Alberta here and how they can participate in this national advantage we have, then you're really missing some big business opportunities. But you're absolutely right. A tremendous opportunity here to not just not just help Alberta and create business opportunities, but I think it's this type of opportunity that is an opportunity to create something more in Canada than we've ever had before.
Hi, my name is Dennis King, and I've got kind of a two-parter. Hillary and Barack have been gaining a lot of traction here recently with their comments about NAFTA and how it's causing all the problems that there are in Ohio where they're campaigning right now. First of all, do you believe that they're reading the situation right? And secondly, should a Democrat be elected president next year, how is that going to affect our manufacturing industry here in Canada?
Well, I think we have to put things into context, that this is in the midst of an election campaign in the U.S., number one. I remember in 1993, we were in the midst of an election campaign when John Chrétien said he was going to reopen NAFTA, too, and that didn't go very far. And I think it's a bit the same. I'm not concerned about NAFTA. In fact, I think this debate shows us the benefit of having NAFTA. Here's an agreement that if anybody's going to reopen it, they need the agreement of Canada and Mexico to reopen it. But what it does do is protect us against kind of arbitrary trade measures that are being taken by the United States, and that is a concern. So I think, if anything, it shows us the benefit of the agreement we've got. Lots of reasons I'd like to reopen NAFTA, but I think we have a better lookout for what we're asking for here. Because it could open up a Pandora's box. I think the other thing is it clearly shows that NAFTA in the U.S. has kind of become a lightning rod for a lot of dissatisfaction about what's going on in the U.S. economy. There's a lot of concern about the loss of manufacturing jobs, loss of services jobs now to Asia. A lot of concern, of course, about the downturn in the U.S. economy. So NAFTA is this lightning rod that the politicians are responding around. But the bigger issue here, and something that I'm very, very concerned about, is that I see, over the last 6 years, the Americans turning into themselves here. We see it in terms of growing protectionist sentiment in the U.S. We see it in the border, where the security provisions and more regulatory provisions are what we call thickening the border, but it's increasing cost. It's making doing business across the border more difficult. We see it in new product regulations right now. The U.S. is responding, for instance, against lead paint issue, and now they're bringing in product regulations on food and on consumer products. Well, there are three specific regulations that are being talked about in the United States right now that would virtually close down the Canadian border for a lot of our exporters. One is a requirement that trucks would have to notify U.S. Customs 24 hours in advance of coming to the border. So, I mean, trucks aren't loaded 24 hours in advance. Second provision is that truckers would have to report where product is placed in their trucks. This is crazy. And the third, which for food processors, talked about a little bit earlier on this morning, is that there's a new requirement out there being proposed that would require food processors to cross the border only where there's an FDA laboratory. Now, I don't know if there even is one on the Alberta border. I know that the only one in Ontario is Buffalo. You know, so imagine tomato growers in Leamington and Kellogg's up in Belleville coming through Buffalo and the some of the stuff going on there. So we just see, I mean, that Buy America, trade actions in the U.S., how the United States is responding against China. We just tend to be sideswiped in a lot of this stuff. And those are issues much more than the NAFTA. But I think this NAFTA debate is much more of a symptomatic of this turning inward in the United States. And we've got to make sure that the Americans see, they of course are focused on the United States and on security. But we've got to convince them that having an open border between Canada and the United States is essential for their economic well-being and for their security. And I would say, you know, if we're closing the border, then the terrorists have won. You know, in terms of our economic security in North America. But those are some of the bigger, real concerns that we have. And I think something that we're going to have to, these are the types of things we've got to notify our members about well in advance, and some of the things we have to be working with the U.S. and with the Canadian Embassy in Washington, too.
I appreciate your analysis of the importance of innovation in manufacturing. And given the fact that my focus is on economic development within our community and our region, I wonder whether you might bring down your analysis from a national level and a provincial level to what a creative community such as Lethbridge could do.
Well, Mayor, I think we were saying over lunch, what I hear about Lethbridge, what I hear is about a community that can come together quickly to solve problems. You know, we're talking about some of the regulatory issues that, you know, can be solved pretty quickly in order to bring a new investment into town. And I think that says a couple of things. It goes to this issue that innovation is all about problem solving and all about creative solutions. And so I think that's clearly... clearly a very important point. And the other issue is that innovation isn't just in new products, new processes. Innovation is just new ways of doing things, new solutions. And it's so as an innovative community here providing those solutions, that's pretty important. And probably, you know, if we're... People usually look at the tax structure, they look at... you know, regulatory costs, and a lot of people try to quantify the economic benefit for new investment coming into a community. Sometimes that's important, but most of the time what I hear are two things that are kind of outstanding, if it's not just being close to your customers. One is, or three things really. One is infrastructure. You know, having adequate infrastructure. But the other two are a little more, more abstract. One is, and this is always the highest, sort of one of the highest issues, what are people like there? What's the education system like? Are there qualified workers in the community? Are we going to be able to attract the people we need in our business? That's clearly a very important priority for anybody making an investment. And the other is just simply, do they want us? You know, as a community, do you want us to come in? And if you do, can you help us solve some of the problems as we're coming into town? you know, can you come to the table and help us out, you know, helping us out with workforce, maybe helping us out with infrastructure, maybe helping us out making a bit of an investment in our innovation activities or in some of the investment we're needed. But it's usually in training and it's in infrastructure. And I think it shows the importance of innovation for companies that are looking to come in, both in well-qualified workforce and in some of their priorities as a business. But I think it also requires communities like Lethbridge that can show they can do this to show sort of what sort of innovative solutions can be provided. And that's very, very important in attracting those investments. So you guys are, you know, you're to be commended on, and I know I was speaking earlier to the economic development group here, but I think Lethbridge is really a flagship for what you have been doing in terms of that innovative approach to attracting business. We should be doing a lot more of this across the country. All right, great. Thanks, Chris.
I'd just like to thank my friend Dr. Jason Myers for coming to Lethbridge. It's a busy time for him, and he made a special trip here in the wake of the federal budget. I think he gave us a real excellent view about what it takes to promote investment and maintain investment, because economic development is not just about attracting, it's about retaining what you've got as well. So good fiscal policy is important both at the provincial, I'd say it's good at the federal, provincial, and the municipal levels if you want to maintain and attract businesses to your area. So I'd just like to thank Dr. Myers for making Lethbridge a special place to be today and for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come and educate us a little bit about manufacturing in Canada. Thank you very much, Dr. Myers.
Thank you very much.
The Alberta Water Council, and there may be some questions on this after lunch.
That's what I'm telling
the Alberta Water Council just became an independent advisory body. So it was Dr. Taylor when he was Minister of Environment created it. Well, now it's independent of government. And so the Water Council is looking at a variety of important areas to try and improve policy and make specific recommendations. So we're looking at wetlands, looking at conservation, efficiency, and productivity of the use of water.
Thank you, Dr. Myers, for spending some time. I'd like to remind everybody there are babies on the table. The charge for lunch today is $10 per person.
The Water Council is a collection of 26 volunteers that are looking at issues across the province, and especially issues of how
And I think the other thing that we do is we work well
many
as a community.
Many of us got together about a year ago and said, you know, people can't seem to find the information they need about water. Where would you go to find out in a watershed I know? Who's got a plan
within the criteria for a management area?
This is the landscape. How do I make my right decisions? So we created the Alberta Water Council to create a new dialogue about water, a partnership between our local councils, IBM, Suncor, you know what, in many days, a lot of people are now in great
increasingly relying on the internet
now in an era where we again information
we need to create a site that everybody can use and perhaps never be restored.
And we have to work with our community
I think
partners.
The jury still lands some of these high waters if they would ever establish
the wetland trust
that will allow us to five times station bank. So we know there's activity already around wetlands restoration in the province. Let's make a business around that restoration. So we try and raise the visibility of the issues to prove our
behaving like Water Conservation Trust of Canada.
A number of us established a trust as a mechanism to get water rights an issue solely for the purpose of saving water and wooden beetle.
Thank you.
Production and cost in downstream communities. So there's activity under the development of the headwaters. So the answer is from a policy standpoint. And again, I have many generations. Maybe raise a few questions.
We go to engineered systems.
But I think the key for us is going to be three things.
Consensus appears
we need to start planning for the next 100 years or
even
more.
The engineered systems will not
we don't
mimic
really
or
inherit
years
so much as we're just borrowing up from the future,
and
that's been an overused phrase. But
in Alberta, we don't have
need
a long
to make
track
some decisions
of how our restoration
that are
irreversible.
Behave.
So, for example, in Alberta, in the riparian
zones,
we need
to kind of 30% of our riparian zone, or the
zone right along
the
river,
access.
And
will not be repaired or restored in our grandchildren's
many generations. And
so we've lost
it, but it's going
to have to.
Now we have to make a decision
today
and assume that we'll make sense
but
hang in the balance. Well, we're not going to see the benefits in the short term, but they're going to be crucial for our grandchildren's grandchildren.
Thank you, Mel.
Secondly, we have to look at some more innovative partnerships so we can look at more solutions. We have a lot of individual partnerships out there, watershed planning groups, industry associations, but we've got to come up with some models that get some of the wealth that's created that we may make a decision about does it go into healthcare, does it go in education, or does it go into the next 100 to 200 years of sustainability. We need to start having that dialogue, and I think it's going to be some of the partnerships that are going to have that dialogue. And then finally, we need to start acting in collective interest as well. Don't assume that the decision about watershed protection or wetland protection is only the decision of the landowner to make when they're faced with an opportunity to subdivide and sell. It's really maybe our collective decision to start making it worthwhile for individuals to make choices that are in our collective best interest. So there you have it, a bunch of questions. I answered some questions with a question.
And
I expect to get challenged on that maybe after lunch. But most of all, I appreciate your interest in the issue and the work that you're doing on trying to tackle these issues.
Well,
because we're going to have to do it together. It's not going to come down to just what us brilliant engineers, can I say that?
So what are they doing in this respect?
But it's actually, it's more about how do we change how society looks at these issues and how do we start acting in collective interest. So thanks again for your interest, and I'm sure we'll have some lively discussion after lunch.
Holding tank. At 1 gallon per minute per day.
And if you want to send me an email and get a PDF of the presentation, just make a note of my email address, and I'll be happy to get it to you.
I want to know what you think about the modification that's being done in North Dakota to transfer the Missouri River into the Red River that flows into Winnipeg.
We're getting short on time, so you have two questions there. One is about the gallons, and the other is about the Missouri River.
Yeah.
Can you go with those to start?
I can, and what will I do if he does?
You'll have to talk with him afterwards. Well, you stay up here, though.
I'll
have a supplemental. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and I'll we'll get together afterwards, and I'll answer all your other questions.
Thanks.
Great.
Yep.
I need a hand. I fall now. This thing, so I know
I saw that man
fall here.
So what we are doing in some of the new community plans, they're looking at cisterns for the purpose of on-site water storage and also fire flows. So we are now starting to, in some of the new communities and estates, plan for storage of water.
So the, regarding the cisterns, we're actually starting to look and to use more of that. The situation on the Red Deer is an international issue, and I'm familiar with it, or on the Red River, rather. I'm familiar with it, but not expert enough to render an opinion. Is it okay if I have one question like that in a Q&A? rather than make something up? But we can talk about that afterward. I went to a specialty conference on it, but it's very complex. 80%? Okay. It's debatable if I'm up to 10 sometimes, so...
Our time is up. We'll take one last question. Is that all right?
My name is Jürgen Borchers, and I was wondering if there's any legislative initiative to norm the industry to supply water-efficient supplies for home use, like water-efficient toilets.
And maybe you know the answer better in Lethbridge. I know in Calgary there are preferred suppliers and rebate programs available from, and I think it's the city administrators as well as the manufacturers, and they would allow you to get a rebate for the purchase of a low-flow fixture or toilet. I looked at that. My brother lives in Invermere, and I looked at whether we could introduce a program like that in Invermere, and, you know, we've had some discussions with the manufacturer about doing that. So there are some programs available, and that's another example of something that can be done at the individual homeowner scale. What was interesting was about a year ago, we did a program on wild rose about conservation at the home level, and then a lot of people phoned in and complained that they used to have washing machines that would take the rinse cycle, park it, and use it in the wash cycle, and you can't get that apparently anymore. It's really kind of interesting, right? Because it's sort of like what's old is new again, and we either do that with small cisterns and storage in the individual home, or we look at new generation of products that would allow us to do that.
Well, I'd sure like to thank Bill Berzins for coming today. He made some accommodations in his schedule to accommodate us. I got an email today that was timed 4:37 a.m. So thank you very much. And as Bill said, we can get his PowerPoint presentation from him by emailing him. I have his email address. Maybe I will pass that on to Trevor Page, and if anyone wants this PowerPoint, they can get it. So thank you very much for coming. We'll see you next week.